devices owned. Be added to what we have on the internet. So as people are going through here, they can look at what kind of zone they're actually talking about before they come and knock on City Planet's office and say, "I'm trying to find this out."
So the in general, for the purposes of the zoning ordinance, the reason they define a specific official zoning is in case there is a change and somebody forgets to slap it on the internet, there is one document that is the official document. Now, it doesn't prevent the city certainly from putting a copy of that on the internet. But
it's identified as a copy.
Yep. And in that way, there's no potential that someone's going to rely on something on the internet without verifying that against the official document. Does that make sense?
I agree. You know, it's come up in conversation, you know, general discussion about this situation and that situation. And when you start talking about what's in here, as opposed to what zone it goes to, because then you have to change area in here to, you know, the rules might apply and they might not apply. Some of them are universal to pretty much all boards. And some of them are specific to a certain area. And zoning impacts that and have letting people find what zone they're talking about, dealing with. Just takes the pressure off.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, but having that designated as,
right,
one official zoning map, and that's
agreed,
where the changes happen, versus
as long as it's identified as not a certified copy, then they, you know, you could even put a disclaimer on it. Verify with City Hall or finance office that this is a valid picture, and at least they know where to go to find the appropriate.
Absolutely.
I got a couple questions. If we go to the fifth page, the definition, we start getting into the isolated structures on Frank. And so if the van's on the line, he wants to put on this county assessor staff and answer this question too. So we've identified lots as a parcel of land occupied or intended for occupancy. And there's lot frontage, and then there's lot measurements, lot of record. So what's the difference between a lot? A lot has been defined. There are 14 lots in a block. And what is a parcel? Parcel would be multiple lots. So or 14 lots. Or what's divided for tax purposes, ownership purposes?
Okay. You were breaking in and out on my phone.
The question I have, okay, we have lot listed here, and lot is defined as a parcel of land. So,
okay.
But we already have it defined. There are 14 lots in a city block, standard city block. So, what then is a parcel compared to a lot? I thought a parcel could be portions of a lot. It could be multiple lots.
It would be a matter of definitions. The county might have a definition of parcel that they use for assessment purposes and things like that, but that doesn't necessarily play here. What you'd be looking more at in that term is potentially a lot record that relates more to flats.
Okay.
So parcel doesn't necessarily be a defined term.
Okay.
Just because that deals more with the county. I think most of the ordinance should refer to lots rather than parcels. And if there is something in there that does say parcel, we can switch that to the lot so that it's better.
I'm sorry, Scott. This is Vance. Were you asking from a county perspective, the difference?
Yeah, actually, because we do have it listed here, as the attorney just said, we do have a definition for a lot of record, which is defined as a lot which is part of a subdivision recorded in the office of the county clerk, or a lot or parcel described by Madison Bound, for which the description has been recorded. So, we know physically what a lot is, but a parcel is a little different. I don't necessarily have to catch up with the county, but sometimes when people come in on a building permit, we need to make sure that we understand the difference.
So you are correct. If somebody owns a set of parcels, well, for us, it would be one parcel. It could consist, like my personal parcel where I live is 2.5 lots, city lots. So let's say, for example, I bought my neighbor's house and I wanted to tear it down. I want to build two houses on it. It would have to become two separate parcels, and that would fall along whatever definitions that was. Maybe one was a lot and a half, and maybe one was a lot, right? So as far as the county is concerned, we look at parcels, and they can be whatever size they are. But to split them off into separate, they have to be 100% owned. There could be no mortgages on them. Like we've had to combine lots that are here in the county. Here in the city, we have to combine lots, and people, let's say someone buys a parcel next to them. Well, you can do that so long as there's no mortgages involved. Then you can combine them. If you have a mortgage on one, you cannot combine two separate parcels. I don't care how many lots or how little lots they actually are. Is that muddy the waters? Does that make any sense?
Actually, to me, it probably clears it up. Need to understand
can I ask Vance a question?
Yes.
A clarification for me. So what you're saying, Vance, if I have one lot, that could be a parcel, and if you have 2.5 lots, that also could be a parcel. The number of lots doesn't matter. It's the ownership of that area that you have your home on. Is that what you're
saying? Exactly. So
okay.
A parcel is whatever is defined. Like mine is 2.5 right here. I own 7 lots on Walnut Street, and the first four lots are one parcel, and then the next 3 lots that I own is a second parcel.
Yes.
Now, because
okay.
those are on different lines, though, like one used to be industrial. The 3 lots used to be an industrial area, and or a different. How do I explain it? I can never combine those lots so I get one tax bill because they are separated by different divisions. You know what I'm saying? So you have the Glenn Peterson area. I can't combine the Glenn Peterson area with something named something different, ever.
Yep.
So
okay.
As far as the current law states, my lots on Walnut Street are always going to be two different. My parcels on Walnut Street are always going to be 2 different parcels. But those 2 parcels span 7 lots, but they also span separate divisions. So because of those divisions, I can never combine them.
That makes sense. Thank you very much.
I will always get two tax bills, no matter how, even if I won't want it, it doesn't matter. And so that's how that kind of works.
Okay.
I'm sure it's clear as mud, but yeah.
No, you did a very good job explaining. Thank you. Well, for me.
But so the lots are important. I don't want to break that out. The lots are important because you can see, let's say there's a lot of growth in Yankton. It pushes our direction and it winds up in Springfield. And somebody owns 6 lots and they decide they want to break it up into or one parcel, but it's 6 lots and they want to break it up into 6 different parcels because they want to sell them separately to people who want to build in Springfield. Well, they can do that, but as long as they follow certain rules to do so, you can literally turn one parcel of 6 lots into 6 separate parcels, as long as they follow those lot lines.
So, if I may tie a little ribbon on it, for the purposes of the county, they have specific definition that they need for taxation purposes for the word parcel. In this definition and in this zoning, parcel is a generic term, meaning a package, a bundle, four corners. So it's the term that the city would rely on here is either a lot, which correlates with can be 2.5 platted lots or a parcel by the county definition, or a lot of record, which is what is recorded at the Register of Deeds office as one lot. Vance apparently has 2.5 platted lots of record. Right?
We do have, and within the individual zoning types, there may be a definition, I see it. So some of them are a little different, and I don't know if we need to say a lot of record, but for like an R1 family residential, 153.045, that's the minimum lot area and width. So for a single family dwelling, the minimum required lot area and width are as follows. The area is 6,160 square feet, and the width is 44 feet. So we do define a minimum for what a lot or lot of
That'd be a lot. So if an old plat had very narrow lots on it, then a lot with, for the purpose of the zoning, has to meet those minimums.
Then we move on to like an R2. The width stays the same, but the area jumps up to 6,336 square feet. When you get into multiple family, there are multiple different ones here. So, talking about an R3 is for high density. A single family dwelling needs to be a minimum of 4,500 square feet. So it is dropped down. Two-family is 2,500 square feet, so that's for much more high-density housing in an R3. It can go all the way down to 1,500 square feet per family, so a multi-family. So now you're talking like a plex, a fourplex, something like that, where they have a minimum of 1,500 square feet. I'm understanding it. It makes sense. Sometimes, obviously, folks will have to be able to explain that. So,
sure. Okay. Thank you. It's going to be challenging.
Especially different places have different definitions. So,
sure.
Okay. That covers that.
I have a couple more things that I would like to address.
Yep. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, I believe we need to also give the definition of a private garage. We state no more than 3 vehicles, but I think we need to be more specific because 3 vehicles, let's face it, if you got 3 2025 smart cars, that's a little bit different than a 1968 Chevy station wagon, you know? So, and I think, you know, somebody might say, well, I need 12 feet in between each of my cars to, so I don't bang into them. So I think we need to have more of a specific of saying, like, maybe a percentage of garage, and saying, instead of saying three vehicles, we need to have more of a square footage. And then, with that being said, I think we need to address accessory buildings' height cannot exceed the height of the main residence on the property. I think we need to be careful with drainage and these extremely high buildings that the house is one storage, but then you're going to allow somebody to build a 2.5 storage machine shed in the backyard. And so I think we need to have something to, we don't need a machine shed that is 6 feet from each of the property lines and 6 feet from the alley and then 5 feet from the dwelling. So I think we need to look at saying something where maybe no more than 30% of the rear yard, or for corner lots, no more than 20% of the side yard can be used for an accessory building. And I say this because of drainage, alley issues. I think we need to be more specific on that. So I guess those are a couple more things I had. And then another question I have is, and this would be specifically, I think, for you, Bo, the covenants. We have, I think, two areas in town that have a covenant. What supersedes, does the ordinance supersede the covenant, or does the covenant supersede the ordinance? And my question here would be, so if we are going to allow an accessory building to be built without a dwelling, if the ordinance says you can't do that, but the people in the covenant say they have no problem with that, which one overrules?
The ordinance. If it's within town limits, the ordinance controls.
The ordinance is...
Regardless of whether a covenant would restrict that further.
Okay.
So if the ordinance says you can allow an isolated accessory structure, but the covenants in an area say you can't, in that case, the covenants would control
would rule over the ordinance.
Well, not over the ordinance. If the ordinance allows it, the covenants don't, so it doesn't. If the ordinance doesn't allow it, but the covenants do, it doesn't, because the ordinance doesn't.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're looking at restrictions in that case.
Yep. Okay.
Whichever is the most restrictive.
And we have three covenants in town, and in general, I think in the one case, there is a blurb, and it probably may not be in this particular packet, about the city's tie to work covenants, you know, and respecting them to the point of they cannot override the ordinance. And if it meets city requirements and the ordinance, it can be approved. The covenant is between those individuals that have signed on to it. And it's up to them to enforce their own covenant. It's not the city's job to, you know. So if it says, a house can't be two stories, but the city says, well, that's fine. There's nothing here that says you can't be two stories. It's up to the signatories of that covenant then to whatever legal action they want to take.
sorry, could you? I know I'm not allowed to speak, but I have a problem with that. This is Carol Hagan.
Yeah, go ahead, Carol.
Because we have had a situation.
Carol,
two of the covenants that I know are in town apply to land of which I'm my trust is an owner. And I know in the past the city has intervened because they have gotten building permit requests, and before the city would allow the building request, they had to get a sign off on all the covenant holders in order to approve the building request. So, Scott, what you just said, is that contrary to what I just said?
But generally, covenants are not governmental issues necessarily. The city is not going to be the arbitrator of covenants between property owners. It's just something that the city does not do through ordinance.
The covenants are filed with the county, and they're part of the record of the requirements for these properties.
Yep. Yeah, so new plats, for instance, might need to be approved if it's in an area with covenants, and that approval process would come in front of the city and the county because it's in town. And in that case, you might need the city to sign off on something. But
the city could not grant them. If there are covenants on this land and they get a building permit and the building permit does not meet the covenants, the city should not be granting that building permit.
No, I would say if it meets the city ordinance, the city can grant the building permit. The covenant is amongst those who have signed on to it, and the city is not a signer, nor is it an enforcer of that. It's probably maybe been a practice that the city decided to do to help out or in approval, but I don't believe there's any requirement of the city not if there's something that's within the ordinance and they can build and a proper building permit is submitted, then if you're a signatory to a covenant in your area, then it becomes the other signatories to the covenant, and you have a legal recourse that make a change to it. But it's not the city's job to enforce a covenant, and it sounds like that's what you're asking.
And that's what the city in the past has taken that position. Let's put it this way. When it came to the building permit, when the city had the hearing on it, they asked the parties to the covenant whether they agreed to it. And when those parties said no, they did not agree to it, the city declined the building permit.
To me, that sounds just like maybe a practice that whoever was doing building permits at the time decided to do, but it wasn't necessarily something they had to do. They just chose to do it at that point.
Well, it was the council acting in its legal capacity.
Yeah, I understand that, but it still was just a practice that particular group decided to do. I don't think there's anything in law that the council or the city has to enforce it. That was that group at that time decided to maybe help honor it, or recognize it and decided to respect it at that point, but not necessarily.
So
there could have been legal recourse by denying it, I would suspect too, but.
Legal position? I'm asking the attorney.
Is that a legal position? I apologize. I don't know enough of the specifics to provide a legal opinion on what you're asking. I wasn't representing the town at the time, and I really don't know enough to answer and give a formal legal opinion on what you're asking. I apologize.
Okay. So we don't know what the, if this were to come up again, we don't know what the legal requirements would be at this point.
What I would advise the council, if an instance came up where the covenants came into question, I would advise the council that there is not a requirement or a legal avenue for a matter that is essentially a civil matter between property.
So even though it's registered with the county, it's a civil matter. It's not a municipality matter.
Right.
I don't understand why it's allowed to be registered then if you're saying it's not.
The register, the purpose of the register of deeds is for notice. It's to put the world on notice that this property belongs to this person and it has these restrictions or covenants. It's not really a government thing. It's to let the world know that there is a public record about that piece of property. That's sort of a general paraphrasing of the legal precept, but again, it's not for the municipality to police those covenants.
Okay, that needs to be investigated on my part. Thank you.
Council wise, do you have any other comments on this? Anything else? We're out here for discussion, so if there's any inputs, we've got a couple, three changes, so things to look out.
The only thing else I have regarding to what I've talked about with these accessory buildings and the garages, I think we also need a definition of what the rear and the side yards are. Like a rear yard is the open space located at the back of a property. You know, at something, I've gone in some of the other communities, how they have done some zoning definitions. And I think that is another definition we need to put in, is what is a rear yard.
Well, we do have that
Okay. Well, what you've got is, again, I think because if we're going to address these accessory buildings, then I think we need to ensure what we're defining as the rear and the side yards for these accessory buildings. Maybe I'm not making myself clear enough.
Yeah, but we do. So, like, if you go to R1, if you go to 153.046, it clearly states minimum required front, side, and rear yards.
But I think you need a definition of what is the beginning and the start of the rear yard. Is it going to be 6 feet from the dwelling, or is it going to be 5 feet from the dwelling?
It goes into
what I other comments about how much lawn and cement are we going to allow. I think we need to start defining what is considered our yardage for the yard. What is defined as the yard? Is the cement going to be concluded on the yard?
So,
Mr. Mayor, could I possibly weigh in? I'm sorry, this is Vance.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I think what she's talking about, and I think it's some confusion that I had as well when I was putting up a fence. So when I put up a fence, according to the ordinance, it says the yard. Well, most people, by definition, consider the yard the area they're responsible for. However, that yard actually is 26 feet back from the curb, right? So my property line is 26 feet back from the curb, but my yard that I'm responsible for, that I plant things on, that I have to mow or else I'm going to get fined, that goes all the way out to the curb. So I think that's what she's saying is that to define more clearly what can constitute your yard. Because when, like in our fence ordinance currently states, you can put something 2.5 feet up that's along your yard. A lot of residents consider, well, I'm responsible for the yard all the way to the curb. So that means I can go to the curb, which is why you have so many things from 15, 20 years ago that are so far out. That are actually that people have fences out here that were put in a long time ago that were built when no one was enforcing them. But they built them out really along the area they're responsible for covering, but what's not actually on their property line. So I think that's what she's asking is, do you define it on the property lines or do you define it along the yard? The yard is kind of a little bit depends on the upon interpretation, right? Exactly.
Kind of a misleading.
So this is why I submitted one last year. I had to submit another one this year once I learned what the city defines as my yard versus what I defined was my yard, right? So I had to resubmit and redo everything to conform to what the city's intent was. However, I was unclear of that based upon the original reading. I think that's what she's referring to.
Okay, so here's our definition that has been in our ordinance for quite some years. A yard is an open space on the same lot with a building, unoccupied and unobstructed from the ground upward, except as otherwise provided herein. In measuring a yard for the purpose of determining the width of a side yard, the depth of the front yard, or the depth of a rear yard, the minimum horizontal distance between the lot line and the main. A front yard is a yard across the full width of the lot extending from the front line of the main building to the front line of the lot. It doesn't say street, it doesn't say curb, it says lot. And then rear and side also have definitions that are to the lot. Or does it say street or curb or ditch or any of those kinds of things. Those are the definitions. They've been here for decades.
Yes, sir. I understand that. What I'm saying is I think what she is saying is that when the verbiage constitutes yard, for a resident, it might get confusing. So maybe taking out yard and making it only the lot lines, you know, like your actual physical lot line, like I had to learn, that makes it more clear, versus any confusion. I just think that's what she's referring to.
I guess I'm not sure how to change. I think it's a pretty clear definition, but I'm not. If it needs some clearing up, I guess I don't know the language to.
I will, like I said, I've been researching different communities and how they're wording some of this stuff. I will shoot something in the next week or two of some of the verbiage that I have picked up from other communities that kind of help with that definition. And if you like it, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. I did my research.
And if I could just briefly address your concerns with percentages of rear yards to be used for accessory buildings. A lot of that, I believe, is addressed by the impervious surface limitations. And to that extent, one of the concerns given staffing here in the city is there are lots that can be irregularly shaped, and figuring out if there is more than 20% in a rear yard, might require a surveyor to go figure that out. So I would caution against getting too complicated in how this is done. Otherwise, your enforcement will be a nightmare for someone from the city to figure out whether or not something is in compliance. So I guess that's my concern is it.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of things here. But the definitions are there on the minimum yards, for instance, where I can see there can be a little confusion, but when you go to the definition, that it clears it up. So all accessory structures shall conform to the same yard requirements as dwellings, except that no private garage may be built closer than 2 feet to a rear lot line. But here's the kicker, no closer than 20 feet to any street line. So street line, if you just read that, you think street. However, it is defined as a street line is the right-of-way line of the street, which is a real thing. Street itself isn't terribly defined, because the street is just defined as a thoroughfare platted for vehicular traffic that's generally wider than an alley and generally including the sidewalk abutting the not street property. So it doesn't say, you know, I know on here it says an alley is at least 16 feet wide, and a street doesn't have a black and white definition. So that one's a little more general, and it's kind of however, but when you get into each individual street that's been platted someplace, you can find that information in the right of way. So that's probably generally where the confusion comes. A curve is, you know, there probably aren't three streets in this town that have the same curve. I don't even think that's listed anywhere in here. But I do understand people think and see that, and sometimes lot lines are tough. We just had a discussion to try to figure out what a lot is, so it's not an easy thing. But in some cases, it's ultimately the responsibility of the owner to figure it out. So
one of the things just I'm sure is going to come up sooner or later, when somebody sits down in the building, they're going to drag out their trusty, rusty paint tracker, and they're going to go from the curb for their measurements. Yeah. Because they don't choose to do anything different. You know, when in reality, there are other things being looked at. So that's where a lot of the confusion and room for vigorous discussion comes in.
I think only maybe one other comment I wrote down on mine. 153.121 is permitted uses and highway commercial. Item F, and I think this goes back to helping to understand how this works. Item F is dwellings. So a principal permitted use in highway commercial are dwellings, as in R1, R2, and R3 may be allowed. My question, and I think my understanding was a little different maybe than what Bo had explained to me, is what that means. I just went back to R2, R3 and looked and then went to permitted uses and went down. That may not be correct, but nowhere in here does it say that you can put accessory buildings in there, and unless it's with the primary purpose or principal use of the district. I would certainly entertain or would like to ensure that we keep commercial areas for the commercial buildings as much as we can. And so I think we've kind of got out of the, we don't want to have too many accessory buildings not attached to a principal use. I would say we probably want to do that.
It does say may.
And then it does say may allow, which maybe that's a legal term that he can help, but because we don't have to allow that. But if it's not a,
if it is a principal permitted use, then it is a use that would be allowed. Even if your language says may, because it's a principal permitted use, a dwelling is allowed in a highway commercial.
Well, then, however we define the dwelling, then however we define the accessory building is also tied to the dwelling. That's what I track on that. So if a accessory building of any kind, you know, a separate garage is allowed in R1, R2, R3, it would be allowed for non-commercial use in highway.
Well, then that's not... When did that get changed? Because back in 1980, that's not the way it was done. So when did this ordinance get changed? Because in 1980, that's the only place in town you could build an accessory building was in commercial or highway commercial.
Well, I don't know that, but it's clearly is not listed here. It would be tied to an R1, an R2, or R3. You can put up a storage warehouse in conjunction with a permitted principal use. You can put up a vehicle storage garage or lots enclosed by a 5-foot high opaque fence or planted screen. And I guess that's, if we call that a vehicle storage garage, but that's not defined as a accessory building at that point. That's a specific thing.
So I didn't make any changes to highway commercial. I didn't insert as a permitted use or a conditional use isolated accessory structure. I would say that it is not allowed. I'd say you'd have to go to the definition of dwelling for the principal permitted use.
What's the permitted principal use under 153.123? Permitted accessory uses in the structures. So there B.
Well, that's a storage warehouse in conjunction with a principal permitted use.
That's my question. What's the permitted use? What's the principal permitted use? If my permitted...
153.121 is what lists the permitted uses for highway commercial. So if you want a storage warehouse with your auto wash, you can do that because an auto wash is a principal permitted use for your construction surface. So then you can have a storage warehouse. As long as you have that permitted use, it would be the same as wanting to put an accessory building with a house. It's item C that I think I'm probably trying to figure out what is a vehicle storage garage. Because then we're diverging then from when this, we're talking about a garage that specifically says a vehicle storage garage. Or lots enclosed by a 5-foot high opaque fence or planted screen. Vehicle storage garage. So if we're going to define garage for not three cars, we should probably tackle this one as well. Just to make sure we're syncing up and not leaving a loophole.
Well, then that's where I go back to where I say the accessory building height cannot exceed the height of the main residence on the property.
Yes, but this isn't defining a vehicle storage garage as an accessory building. It's defining it as a vehicle storage garage. So
what I'm going back to is in R1 and R2, in your residential area, I'm going back to that now. You're dealing just with the commercial property right now.
Well, and in a commercial property, it says you can do an R1, R2, R3. So I think it's a loophole that And a definition that we need to make sure is tied. We're going to define a garage or storage. Is this an accessory? This is listed as an accessory use, so the vehicle storage garage should probably also be addressed with a primary use. I think it's probably implied, but it's not explicit like the other one is as far as having that tied to a principal use, which there's 24 principal uses. So
the way the highway commercial is currently defined, it has as an accessory use a vehicle storage garage, but you can only have that if you have one of the principal permitted uses. And again, it's not necessarily R1, R2, R3. And a principal permitted use is a dwelling. But you can build a house in an R1 highway commercial as a principal permitted use currently under what your ordinance has. But it at this point does not address isolated accessory structures without inserting them. And I guess what really hasn't been discussed is whether, is the, you know, reading the temperature of the room, whether that is something that the council intends to pursue with this ordinance change, is whether or not like to move forward with isolated accessory structure, because it will change some of the definitions that we would insert and at least that section there. But if you had any direction on sort of what you're feeling at this point, whether to move forward with that or not, I'd appreciate it.
Whatever argument we're going to use for that 153-123C, need to transfer that same argument to a 153-139C, because they basically say the same thing. The only difference is one area is industrial and the other area is commercial, highway commercial. That's the only thing that changes between the two, really. So the description needs to be considered in there as well. And in this particular case, 139 talks about accessory uses, which may be an impact on that.
So the primary use is the main purpose, so a house on the residential. And then the accessory use is, in addition to having a primary, you would need to have, you could have some other thing, garage, a heat shed, something like that. So that would be the difference between principal permitted uses and accessory.
Any additional items, or we'll move on? Got a little bit, we got a few edits, and certainly some definitions to make sure we're all aware of. Okay, this was a discussion thing, so any other questions? Great, hearing none, then let's move on to resolution 2025-02 to amend the library budget.
This is basically using, going along with SCCL 9-21-9.2, which we have received, or the city received funding for a donation that to be used towards the pill program. So that's what we're amending the budget for initially. So it would be a resolution to increase the library budget by $400.
What amount was that, Amanda? You cut out on me.
It was $400.
Oh, okay.
Funds were made available through two donations, Schwab Charitable and Irene Cooley in amounts of $250 and $150 respectively. So this would increase the budget for the library by $400. So it states, whereas the city council of the city of Springfield has determined that city expenditures for expanding the library inventory were paid to the Pilcrow Foundation in the amount of $400. And whereas funds were made available through two donations, Schwab Charitable and Irene Cooley received in the amounts of $250 and $150 respectively, whereas SDCL 9-21-9.2 authorized the municipality to reimburse for such expenditures to be restored to the fund from which originally drawn, and the deposit of the same shall restore the budget of such fund in the amount of the reimbursement. Therefore, be it resolved that City Council of the City of Springfield that the library budget will be increased by $400. In layman's terms, they received the Pilcrow grant. They needed to expend $400 out of their budget. They received donations to replace that $400 in their budget. So it's they get some back to where they were. That's what this resolution is. And it moves those donations from the general fund into the library fund. Am I right?
Library is the library, department the of department, the general fund.
Yeah. Okay. Is there action on resolution 2025-02?
Make a motion to approve the 2025.02 resolution to amend the library budget as presented.
There a second?
I'll second.
So the motion by Steve, seconded by Larry, to approve resolution 2025-02 to amend library budget by $400 as presented. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. So that motion carries. All right, next item. And this is, the next item is the first reading of Ordinance 623. For the 2026 budget appropriations.
Well, and actually, I will have to amend that because I think that, especially with going through the open laws, meeting laws, that I didn't add it to the packet, the budget. Council members got it, but it was not in the packet. So we will not be able to. Okay. I apologize.
Okay, so that said, we cannot do the first reading. We will have to come up with a plan to do that to ensure that it is at least the draft, the first reading form is published for public review. Okay, so with that being said, we can make a motion to table it, which does still allow us to have discussions on the budget in 26 on the appropriation. So the action I think that we're looking at is to table the first reading of the Ordinance 623 for 2026 budget appropriations as presented. Action on that.
I'll make the table 6.3.
Is there a second?
Second.
So Larry's made the motion to table first reading of ordinance number 6.3 for 2026 budget appropriations. As presented, Steve has seconded. And the discussion, primary discussion piece being is that did not get included in the public packet, so we do need to defer the first reading as it gets published. So, but we can discuss it before we do the vote on it, and we don't need to do roll call. So are there questions, discussions on budget? Questions? Okay. All right. Well, in that case, since the motion has been made to table, then what does the future look like? Table it now.
That would be interesting.
So, for the council members present, I guess you have one of two options. We can, when we table it now, we can either plan for a special meeting to have it published so everyone knows, or we just simply do it in September.
I would do it in September. If there's no other reason to have a special meeting, why waste taxpayers' money?
State law does say we have to have it done by the 10th of September for the first reading. So,
when is our September meeting?
Which is a Thursday because it's Labor Day week.
September 3rd?
4th.
4th. Okay, thank you.
So that would work. That pushes the second reading there. So. Which we don't have to decide right now, but other than the table. So, any other comments or questions on that? We did not go over payroll, so we'll have to do that. That in executive session individually. So, with two council members not in the room, we'll have to do that whenever we do the first reading. So. Okay, so the motion is to table a first reading of Ordinance 623, 2026 budget appropriations as presented. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Absent. So that Ordinance 623 is on the table at this time. Next item, approved code of ethics and conduct for elected and appointed officials.
And those materials, the code of conduct as well as the personnel policy manual section one was supplied to you at the last meeting. The request was to go through and let me know of any changes or updates that you would see that would need to be amended before approval. And there were a couple changes that happened today. If you look at policy CE 1.2, it says, accordingly, members of the common council and, well, this is what it would change to, because it says, therefore, members of the common council and of all boards and commissions shall conduct themselves in accordance with the following ethical standards. The amendment would be to say, accordingly, members of the common council and all boards and commissions shall adhere to the following ethical standards. So just a reword, because it was a little... So there's that one.
You said accordingly.
And in number 10, it is the fourth line. It's a sphere. It should say up here. In 11, there was member shall represent the official policies that we're going to look at the second sentence and rewording that to when expressing personal opinions or positions, members shall clearly state that they do not represent their respective board, commission, or the city of Springfield, nor shall they allow any inference to the contrary. Okay. So then that one's fine. And if we go to policy CE 1.3, the question was on item 2F2. It says members of the public addressing the council shall begin their remarks with their name and mailing address. The question is, should be mailing or physical? Members of the public addressing the council shall begin their remarks with their name and mailing address. Should it be mailing or physical address?
I mean, if you're trying to determine whether they're a resident, then based on their business.
Okay, that's. So then that would be it. And then policy CE 1.4 in item 2A. It says the city of Spearfish in number or in line 3, which obviously that should say city of Springfield. You can tell where I was borrowing. Close. So that's what I would recommend on the quote. And at this point, I would also say to table that just because those changes were made today and didn't avail.
What was that you just said, Amanda? I didn't hear you.
Sorry, I was mumbling. I would say at this point, with those changes that happened today, and since that wasn't available to the public either, we should probably table that as well.
Does this need to be done sooner than September 4th?
No.
Okay.
This is an internal thing.
Okay.
Table it.
Are you making a motion, Steve?
Make a motion to table.
Is there a second? So Steve's made the motion, Cheryl has seconded to table the code of ethics and conduct for elected and appointed officials as amended. Any other questions or comments? She'll get the changes updated so there's a fresh copy out there. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. So that will be tabled until a future meeting. September meeting. All right, so the next one is Personal Policy Manual Section 1, Purpose and Use.
Okay, so then if we look at policy PP 1.1, this is just changing that last sentence into two. Basically saying, welcome to our team of hardworking and talented staff. We wish you great success in your new position. Just claiming that. And then on policy PP 1.7, I think this is just another kind of cleanup thing where the personnel manual is available to all staff through the city's SharePoint. I'm wondering if we should actually just change that to, is available to all staff through the finance office, and I don't know if we even need to say technological needs or have that option.
Yep.
So just changing that to the city's finance office. So in that same vein, I would probably say the table and then we should be quick.
Hey, did everybody catch that, those changes in the recommendation? Hearing nothing, the recommendation is tabled to provide time to make those couple edits. So is there an action to table the Personal Policy Manual Section 1 as amended?
Make that motion.
For a second.
I'll second.
Okay. So Steve's made the motion to, table Personal Policy Manual Section 1, Purpose and Use, as amended. Larry seconded. Any other discussions? Hearing none, finance officer will make those edits and get a revised version out for the next meeting. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay. So that passes there. Our last item on the agenda is a review of the open meeting laws 2025 per brochure, Senate Bill 74. This is new. As a fact, when I was in Pier 2 weeks ago or 2.5 weeks ago, this had not been published at that point. So this is extremely new. This is just a review and the attorney can help me out. I'll hit a couple of high points and, again, the open meeting laws, I think the number one thing is, this is prepared by the Attorney General's office with the South Dakota News Media Association. The definition of South Dakota open meeting laws are found in SBCL Chapter 1-25. It requires that official meetings of public bodies must be public and advance notice is to be given of such meetings. It defines an official meeting as one where a quorum of the public body is present and at which official business or public policy is discussed or decided. Who does it apply to? It applies to cities, counties, school boards, other public bodies. It does not include bodies that serve only in an advisory capacity, so such as the airport advisory board within the city. This would not be by definition. Are teleconferences considered public meetings? We are doing it right now. The answer is yes. Open meetings laws allow to allow meetings, including executive or closed meetings, to be conducted by teleconference, which is defined as an exchange of information by audio, video, or electronic means, including the internet. If a place is provided for the public to participate for that. In addition, a teleconference where less than a quorum of the public body is present at the location open to the public, which will always nearly always be this building, then arrangements must be made for the public to listen by telephone or internet. The city of Springfield has done that. We do have a dial-in number, as is evident by those that have joined us today. So we can meet that intent whether we're here or we have to do it in this first meeting. Media and public must be notified of teleconference meetings in the same manner as any other meetings, teleconference only. How is the public notified? Requires that all public subdivisions except state and its boards, commissions, or departments prominently post a notice and copy of the proposed agenda at the political subdivision's principal office here in Springfield. It is outside the Springfield Community Services Center on the north side on the bulletin board. It must include a proposed agenda with a date, time, and location of the meeting. It must be visible and readable and accessible to the public for 24 continuous hours immediately preceding the meeting. Also, if it has its own website, which we do, those must be posted on the website as well. The notice must be delivered in person by mail or email or by telephone to all local news media who have asked to be notified. And it is a good practice to ask media to renew their requests on a regular basis to ensure proper notification. And just so there is a note here so that folks know that the state agencies, boards, and commissions have a slightly different law, which is actually a 72-hour continuous meeting posting, which does not include weekends or holidays. So they are slightly different. Is public comment required? Yes. Public bodies are required to provide in every official meeting a period of time on their agenda for public comment. Each public body has the discretion to limit public comment to the time allowed for each topic and to the total time allowed for public comment. Public comment is not required at meetings held solely for an executive session, inauguration, a presentation of an annual report, or the swearing in of elected officials. Can public meetings be recorded? Yes, public meeting, public bodies, yes. SBCL 1-25-11 requires public bodies to allow recording, not the public body recording it, but anyone that would choose to come here to record it. If the recording is reasonable, obvious, and not disruptive. And that does not apply to those portions of a meeting confidential or closed to the public. When can a meeting be closed to the public and the media? It can be closed to the public body. Allows a public body to close a meeting for the following purposes. One, discuss personnel issues pertaining to officers or employees. Two, consider the performance or discipline of a student. That would be the school board side. Three is consulting with legal counsel. Reviewing communications with legal counsel regarding litigation, pending litigation or contractual matters. Four would be an employee contract negotiation. Five is to discuss marketing or pricing strategies of publicly owned competitive businesses. Or six, to discuss information related to the protection of public or private property, such as emergency management response plans or other public safety information. Meetings may also be closed by cities and counties for certain economic development matters. And any official action based on discussions in executive session must, however, be made at an open meeting. The proper procedure for an executive session is for a motion and to enter into it. Discussions in executive session must be strictly limited to the announced subject. No official votes may be taken on any matter during executive session. And the public body must return to open session before any official action can be taken. Close. Agenda items. May agenda items be considered if they are added less than 24 hours before a meeting? Yes. Proposed agendas for public meetings must be posted at least 24 hours in advance. This is to provide advance notice of topics to be discussed, but it is not entirely all of them. Typically, a public body adopts the final agenda upon convening the meeting, which we do at every meeting that we conduct. At the time the final agenda is adopted, the government body may add or delete items and may also change the order of business. New items cannot be added after the agenda has been adopted by the governing body. Public bodies are strongly encouraged to provide at least 24-hour notice of all agenda items. Be fair to the public. We do as best as we can, but some of these things are actually outside of our control, though that is what needs to be action. So do the best we can, possibly can. So, for special and rescheduled meetings, public bodies are to comply to the extent the circumstances permit. In other words, posting less than 24 hours in advance may be permissible in emergency. Our email discussions, meetings for purposes of the open meeting law. The definition of an official meeting specifically includes meetings conducted by electronic means, including electronic mail, instant messaging, social media, text messaging, and virtual meeting platforms. A quorum of the public body that discusses official business of that body via electronic means is discussing an official meeting for the purpose of open meeting laws. However, electronic communications made solely for scheduling purposes do not fall within the definition of official meeting. Records that must be made available to the public in conjunction with the public meeting, the public body must post meeting materials on the public body's website or make those materials available to the public at least 24 hours prior to the hearing or when made available to the members of the public body, whichever is later. Finally, SDCL 1-27-1, 5.17 requires that draft minutes of public meetings must be made available to the public at the principal place of business for the public body within 10 business days after the meeting, or on a website of the public body within 5 days. Over 10 days. We do post ours on the boards and commissions site for Springfield that is posted there, and we have a link from our public website. Requirements for task forces. Task forces, committees, and working groups that are not created by statute, ordinance, or proclamation, or are advisory only may not be subject to public meeting law, but are encouraged to comply to the extent. And are public bodies required to review open meeting laws? The answer now is yes. Each public body must report in its minutes that the annual review of the open meeting laws was complete. There is not any specific month or time when you need to do that, just in. It is possible for media or the public, if you're excluded or feel you're excluded from a meeting or a violation of an open meeting laws occur. Open Meeting Commission is the organization which would to refer complaints or allegations of a violation. Must make complaints to law enforcement officials in the county where the offense occurred. After a signed and notarized complaint is made under oath, any necessary investigation is conducted, the state's attorney may choose to prosecute a misdemeanor, find that the matter has no merits, and file a report with the attorney general or forward a complaint to the Open Meetings Commission for further determination. The Open Meetings Commission is comprised of 5 state's attorneys or deputy state's attorneys, appointed by the Attorney General. If you have questions on the procedures or status of a pending case, you contact the Attorney General's office. Talk with the assistant for Open Meetings Commission. Procedures for the Open Meeting Commission are posted on the website for the Office of Attorney General at http://atg.sd.gov. That is the items that I gleaned off of that, so for review for everyone.
I have a question.
Yes.
Where does it say that the public body gets to dictate what people get to talk about in public input?
Comment again.
Public comment is on page 3.
Yes. Yes. Public bodies are required to provide at every official meeting a period of time on their agenda for public meeting. SDCL 1-25-1. Each public body has the discretion to limit public comment as to the time allowed for each topic commented on and as to the total time allowed for public comment. Public comment is not required for meetings, you know, solely in executive session. So it provides a significant degree of discretion to the body to place time or otherwise restrictions on what could be commented on or when. I would note that, as the general rule of thumb, when we say that if you're in public comment, only comment on something not on the agenda. That's because when we get to the agenda item, as we just demonstrated tonight, members of the public have been invited to or have asked to comment on that specific agenda item.
Okay. As long as it's they can speak on the agenda item during the time frame on the agenda.
The purpose of that is to not, you know, be here And there is no set time when public comment is within the agenda either. It can be the very last item. We normally have it up front. So that's just up here. If there's something on the agenda, if you want to spend your time commenting on something that we're going to turn around and discuss. But again, it doesn't say that we could public comment at the end. Under great discretion. Anything to add? The primary items I got out would have been for a review. I think the big thing that happened this year was they're starting to define the electronic. Start understanding that that's what does that constitute as far as discussions. So I will add, once again, I sat through the Assistant Attorney General's presentation, the elected leaders training, and even at that level, it's pretty non-committal, to say the least, as far as what basically the general answer is, well, until there's a specific case, they can't really answer that. So it's pretty good at that. They tend not to answer. Okay. With that, there's no other business. Since we only have two council members here, I have nothing for executive session. I don't know if anybody else has. So I will visit with each council member individually on some items within the police department and the personnel as far as the training and how Karen is getting integrated in and what the future looks like for him and what that individual. So that's the fight for the day. It's up and running. With that, the next meeting. It's a decision point. September 1st is the first Monday in September, which is Labor Day. So per our pre-approved annual schedule, let's move the city council meeting to Thursday, September 4th at 6:30 p.m. In the event that we need a special meeting in between. We'll reach out again and just kind of keep in mind if we need something towards the middle of August for any reasons. Right now, the only thing I can really foresee is if we need to make another change in the water plant. Coming close to items that are time that require change. Okay. Again, first day of school is August 14th. Special legislative session to deal with the men's prison construction is September 23rd. So, expect we'll start to see more of that come up as we get closer. And I would expect that there is an impact on it. Yeah. So, please, if you see Garrett out, as he starts to get out, please introduce yourself and try to get him around and start to keep up with him. Up the downtown and so and kind of what came up. We need to find Garrett a home in town as well. Okay. With that, entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make that motion to adjourn.
You made the motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Hold on a second.
Being said, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. It is 9:20. We stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.